Blog Talk Radio.
Now on with the show and our.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Now on with the show, and our guest today for the full hour is Dr. Dmitry Gorenberg. He's a senior analyst at CNA. He's also an associate at Harvard's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He's also author of the book Minority Ethnic Mobilization in the Russian Federation. You can also find his works at a link over at my home blog. And also, there's another link that will take you to his latest thoughts that he keeps up on his blog on Russian military and Russian military reform. You can find that at russiamil.wordpress.com, or you can just click the link over at my home blog. So in addition to what the work he's done on the Russian military, we're also going to kind of broaden our scope a bit because we do have the good doctor for the whole hour. And we're going to kind of talk a bit about Russia in the 21st century, especially for the old Cold Warriors among us. It's good to get an update on what Russia is or is not now compared to what many of us had set in our younger years, and maybe look a little bit at its domestic politics, demographics, its relationship with the rise of China, and the ongoing evolution that we see in its near abroad in the former Soviet republics, and how that is challenging this nation that continues to be very important. Dmitry, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And thank you very much again for taking a full hour today to come with us on a subject a lot of our regular listeners have pinged on us, saying you need to spend some time on Russia, and they've been exactly right, and it's going to be great to have you here for a full hour. Just to kind of tee the ball up for a bit on those that have been distracted, as many people have in the last few years, on Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East, and things of that manner. If you could talk about the work that you and some of your colleagues have been doing over at CNA, focusing on Russia, and if some of our listeners wanted to catch up, what would they expect to see there?
Well, our work at CNA is, and I should say from the start that I'm representing myself here, and nothing I say is represents what CNA's opinions. I just want to make that clear. But the kind of work we've been doing recently is primarily focused on the Navy, just because that's been kind of at the core of CNA's mission, and trying to keep abreast of what's going on with the Russian Navy as it kind of comes out of kind of a dead period, I guess you'd call it, for over the from the 90s up through about 2005, when there really wasn't much going on, and then over the last 5 years or so, we've seen a little bit of a revival, so we've been trying to track that. In addition to that, we've been there's been a lot of interest in kind of Russia's southern flank, so we've been doing some work on the Caspian recently and on the Black Sea before that, so just looking at kind of more broadly the strategy that the U.S. should follow in the region, what the regional security situations like, what the priorities of some of the main players both in the region and outside the region, which now increasingly includes not just kind of the usual suspects, U.S., Iran, Russia, but also increasingly includes China, which is becoming quite an important player in that region. So that's the kind of work we've been doing recently.
Eagle One?
Oh, sorry. What is the current situation with the Russian Navy? What are they doing, and why are they doing it, and what should we expect as we plog along here?
Sure. Well, I think the recently they've kind of started to redefine their missions a bit, and just looking at shipbuilding plans as one of the main kind of ways to forecast what they're going to be doing in the future, since a lot of times, the verbiage is just kind of talk about You know, what were, you know, there's nothing, if there's no ships behind it, it doesn't really mean much if they say we're going to have grand plans of various kinds. So what I see happening is, first of all, primary focus on coastal defense, and then the other main missions is protecting sea lanes of communication, especially anti-piracy kind of work, and then a real shift in focus from whereas traditionally the Northern Fleet was the most important, so kind of what I've taken to calling the shift from the north and west to the south and east. So they're really kind of looking forward, and over the next 10 years, they really want to beef up the Pacific Fleet, and also to modernize the Black Sea Fleet. Now, the Black Sea Fleet was in a real, for the moment, in really poor shape because they really haven't put any new ships there in, since probably 1991, because of tensions with Ukraine over basing in Sevastopol. Well, when they signed an extension of the lease on that base last year, extending it out to 2042, now they have the confidence to start putting a lot more new ships there. So there are going to be some ships will be transferred from the Baltic to the Black Sea fleet. There's going to be, they just announced I think last week that both of the Mistral ships that they're going to purchase from France, both the two that are actually going to be built in France early on, are both going to go to the Pacific fleet. So you can see that that's kind of where the priority is going to be, rather than the Northern Fleet and the Baltic. And part of that, I think, is, and we'll probably talk more about this, but, you know, the fear of China. They have this idea that, whether correct or not, that their Navy is still competitive with the Chinese Navy, whereas in terms of ground forces, they're afraid they just get overwhelmed by sheer numbers. So they think that somehow with naval forces they can restrain China. I don't know. I'm skeptical about the prospects of any conflict between China and Russia in the first place. But that at least is kind of where they're thinking about. And there's also the question of the Kuril Islands dispute with Japan, which again I don't think is something that would lead to actual military conflict. But at least there's more tension there than there is, say, with Europe.
Early on in your answer, you brought up the fact that one of the missions that the Russian Navy has right now, in addition to, you know, close ashore, was piracy. And a couple of shows ago, our guest was Captain Alexander Martin. He was the leader of the Marine Corps Force Recon that took back one of the ships that was hijacked, rescued 11 people, took 9 Somali pirates into custody without a single loss of life. But one thing we talked about is most of the international community, whether they're with the EU Force Atlanta or Task Force 151 or 150 or, you know, some of the other nations that are independent operations, most of them just sit there and watch. But when you look at the nations that are actually taking action out there, it kind of runs the spectrum where you have the Dutch on one end that will, you know, shoot out a skiff's motor, but then give food and water to the pirates so they can go home. In the middle, you have the Americans that will act if they have to. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have the South Koreans, who their op is, we're going to take the ship and kill everybody but the people that need rescuing. And the Russians kind of take it to another notch in how they respond to pirates. In the Russian literature, what is different in their view of piracy? Or is it just a national habit that allows them to be so much more aggressive in their response to piracy when they're directed to do so?
Well, I see it as I think throughout Russian military history there isn't the same concern about casualties, I guess is the way I would phrase it. And that applies not just to the people they're fighting, but also their own people. and civilians. So I think there's, you know, if there's a mission that I think translates to this mission, where they just, you know, their goal is to get the job done, and if, you know, if the bad guys are bad guys, then we don't mind to, you know, we're not going to worry too much about humanitarianism or whatever, and we'll kill them if that's the best way to get them. So I think that's it's kind of a mindset issue, I think, where a lot of the Western militaries are more concerned about rules of engagement and that kind of thing. That's just not something that Russians have focused on as much in this particular way.
Eagle One?
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that the Mistrals, that the which are large amphibious ships made by France,
right,
that the Russians are buying, are going to go to the Pacific Fleet. And I have a couple of questions about those. One is, why are they buying ships from France? And what is there a problem with their own shipbuilding industry? And secondly, how big is the threat they perceive from the Japanese with respect to the Kurils? Or is it just that this is a place they need them because of the Chinese threat, too?
Well, let's see. On the shipbuilding, I think there's a big problem with the shipbuilding industry, and this is actually the reason, the core reason why they're buying these ships, is that it's, you know, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about whether the Mistral they're doing this to somehow divide NATO, or they're going to threaten Georgia or the Baltic states with these ships. But I think that's not what it's about. This is really about finding a way to renovate their shipbuilding industry by getting the French to come and help them build a new plant, essentially. And then why specifically the Mistral? I think that I have less information on this, but my sense is that they thought a ship like this would be less threatening than if they, you know, went and bought a destroyer or something. So that's kind of where it's at. As far as what's going on with the shipbuilding industry, you know, there was, throughout the 90s and the last decade, until about 2005 or so, there was very little financing for all domestic, the entire armaments industry. It basically survived only because of foreign sales. So a lot of the best people, you know, the best engineers and workers and so forth, that was not an industry that they went into during that period. Whereas in the Soviet period, that was a very high prestige occupation. So meanwhile, over time, the older people who were good were retiring. So you have no new good people coming in. The qualified people are retiring. So over time, you have a lot of opportunities for poor workmanship, for defects, and that sort of thing. We saw that not just in the Navy, but, you know, with building some of the nuclear, you know, the new Bulava missiles that they had a lot of defects with. So that's kind of the background, and you see with a lot of the ships they've been building domestically that it takes a long time. And even when there's financing, it takes a long time because the plants have not been modernized, and there's this manpower problem that I mentioned. So I think this was kind of a way to get the people on to get back to a higher level of expertise in shipbuilding. In terms of the threats, again, I think that this is a case of, this was the ship that for whatever reason they decided to get, and then they had to find some missions for it. So rather than saying, okay, we're going to have a problem with China or with Japan, so we're going to get the right kind of ship to deal with that problem, it's kind of backwards. we've got these ships, they're coming, what are we going to do with them? Well, we can bring some people, you know, if we need to ferry a whole bunch of naval infantry out to the Kurils, well, we can use it for that. So that, I think, and I think that there may also be a political factor where they know that there was all this tension with NATO, or some NATO states, I should say, with the Baltics states, and then also with Georgia, over the their fear of having these Mistral ships in the Black Sea or the Baltics. So they say, okay, well, fine, we'll put them in the Pacific where those political tensions won't be as activated. And then later on, the third or fourth ship, which will show up in, you know, 5 or 6 years at best, we can put one of those in the Black Sea, let's say.
Yeah, I was impressed with the Russian decision. I talked to a few years ago, a French and an Italian naval officer who had a chance to be on the Mistral class ship, and they were both very impressed with it. So good for the Russians. If they build it right, they're going to get a nice little ship on their back. And kind of shift focus just a little bit. Towards the end of last year, you could have been somebody who went into a coma in the mid-80s and had just come out, and if you turned on the TV, you would have thought that nothing had changed because they're up there talking about the START treaty. Looking at it just from a distance, it's almost a just temporal disturbance. You know, why is this START treaty so important in the second decade of the 21st century? And there's a lot of the discussion about the U.S. domestic politics of it and, you know, the lame duck Congress, but really wasn't any good in-depth discussion about why this was important, not from our perspective, but from the Russian perspective. What did the Russians see in this START treaty, and what were they hoping to gain from it?
Well, I think the main thing that's important for them is, and I think it's very much the same thing that's important for the U.S. once we get past the politics and all that, is the verification regime. That without the START treaty, there was really no way for each side to know what the other side was actually doing. And with the treaty in place, it basically restores more or less the same regime that we had under the previous treaty that expired, where they can send inspectors to our nuclear facilities, and we can our military, you know, to make sure that the treaty is being followed, and we can do the same thing on their to their facilities, and so that just increases the level of certainty about what nobody's you know, messing around, basically, and so that trust just makes, you know, everyone feel, you know, all the people working on the nuclear and strategic issues just feel that much calmer, that they're aware of what's going on in the other major nuclear power. So that, I think, is a big advantage for them. The other thing that they're, you know, given their spending on nuclear weapons, they were kind of getting down towards some of the limits of the you know, on a number of warheads and so forth. Anyway, I mean, and so this was a way they thought they could make sure that the U.S. doesn't, for some reason, start building up lots of missiles, which they can't afford. So I think those were the two main reasons for Russia to focus on having this treaty, and I think it may proved to be a good base for further. I know this is something that U.S. politicians talked about, and I think Russian politicians are also interested in trying to go further on nuclear disarmament. Now, that's a very difficult road, and I'm not particularly optimistic in how far they'll get on that. But that's at least a baseline for further discussions along those lines.
Out of the START type thinking, over the years, at least in the Western press, we've seen a lot of articles that seem to portray Russia as kind of a bully with respect to, like, their natural gas pipelines and sort of forcing people to comply with to bow to the Russian desires for some type of security for the Russians. I mean, is that an accurate representation of what they're doing? Is it just a, or is that a bias built into our press? Or are they basically that much of a bully nation when it comes to getting what they want and not caring about the techniques they choose to use?
Well, I think their primary goal in with the pipelines was actually not so much political benefits, but economic benefits. So, yeah, they did use, with the famous gas shutoffs with Ukraine. But it was about prices, and so that was about. Now there were certainly political elements involved, and they certainly gave discounts to their friends. But their sense was, if you're not going to be our friend, we're going to charge you the market rate because we're gonna make money off of you then. And so I think that was the primary thing that was going on. Now, of course, as any good monopolists, they wanted to maintain their monopoly. So that was a lot of the politics around, what people were calling the second great game, about where the pipelines would go and the various U.S. and European efforts to build new pipelines from the Caspian region to bypass Russia, and Russia resisting. Well, of course they were resisting, because as long as there were no other options, then they could buy Turkmenistani gas for $50 a cubic billion. I'm not sure what the pricing is at a significant discount, and then resell it for two or three times that price in Europe. So that was, and then once those alternative pipelines were built, they couldn't do that anymore. So one interesting thing about this pipeline game is that on that, Russia's pretty much now lost. There's no more Russian pipeline monopoly from the Caspian or Central Asia, because while they were pushing South Stream, we were pushing Nabucco. These are different pipelines for how to get gas from Europe, gas from Central Asia to Europe, either via Russia or not. The Chinese just went ahead and built big pipeline to Turkmenistan, and they can import gas. And so, which means Turkmenistan now has an option. They can go through Russia, they can go through China. They still would like to build another option to Europe, but it's not, from the supply side, they don't care as much. There's still the question of supplying alternative supplies to Europe, which, there are a few primarily Central European countries that still get pretty much all their natural gas from Russia. But that is also becoming less of a long-term concern because of LNG, liquefied natural gas, is becoming a much bigger presence in the European market. And down the road, the possibility of shale gas, which is now being exploited in the U.S., and that technology going over to Europe. And there's a lot of natural gas shale deposits in places like Poland and elsewhere. So that they could change that around. So I think that the politics, the political aspects of Russian pipelines are on a down, are becoming less important, and over time we'll see more just pipelines being built because of economic decisions, whether what's the best way to get it to market in the cheapest way, rather than the security aspects that played a role in the last, let's say, 10, 15 years. But I don't think it's so much that they were, bullying other countries for political reasons, but just that they figured they had the leverage for economic reasons and they wanted to use it.
While we're toying with the little dangerous game of trying to get inside the Russian mind, we were talking about the bullying aspect of it. I was reminded a few years ago, I was in St. Petersburg, and I was sitting there with my minder/tourist guide, and we just talked for a couple of minutes. We're by the side of the road waiting for the bus to fill up, and this big truck goes by, just filled up with what looked like aluminum ingots headed for the port there in St. Petersburg. And he said something interesting to me with a rather bitter look on his face. He's like, I don't know what's happened to my country. We used to build things. Now all we do is we rip things out of the land and we sell it to other people, but we don't build anything anymore. And I didn't want to go down that road with him because that look on that face was kind of spoke volumes. But in there, since the fall of the Soviet Union, that decreased importance, what impact has that had on the Russian psyche and how they see themselves and their role in the war in the world? That feeling of their importance is diminished. Does that play into that attitude that we see some?
Yeah, I think, maybe more so with the politicians than with the regular people, but it does. Yeah, it certainly does play a role. I mean, it's always hard to talk about, to generalize about the Russian psyche, because there's a lot of difference between if you're in Moscow versus in some rural area, or even in a city that's not in the capital city. So there's a lot of, and among the people, if you're talking to the intellectuals versus, some nationalists or something, you're going to get a lot of differences in opinion as well. Overall, though, I think there was certainly this feeling of humiliation, I guess, where, you went, the people sort of went from being living in the greatest country on earth, or at worst the second greatest, to a place that was dependent on in many ways on handouts in the 90s, or at least felt itself to be, and there was a lot of the decline in U.S. Russian relations had to do with perceptions on their side. They were given bad advice by American, or in some cases European, advisors about how to rebuild their, how to restructure their economy from the communist model to the market model, and also how to develop their political institutions. So all those things kind of got conflated into this perception that the advice that they were given didn't help. And now there's variation. Some people who are more anti-Western feel that this bad advice was given deliberately, and it was part of some kind of plot to weaken Russia or even destroy it, whereas other people are more kind of cognizant that this didn't work, for whether maybe it was met well, maybe not, but it's not something that was any kind of a CIA plot or anything. But there was this kind of feeling of we need to restore our greatness ourselves, because outside advice, for whatever reason, we're not, either we're not like the West, or their advice didn't work for us, or it wasn't meant to work for us. But whatever, it didn't work. We got to do it ourselves. So we're gonna, and this is where Putin came in 2000 with kind of a it's like, if you remember Ronald Reagan's line this morning in America, well, it's this kind of mourning, and we're gonna rebuild Russia. It's gonna be mourning in Russia. We're gonna restore our economy. We're gonna be great again. And there was a lot of rhetoric there. Now there's a gap between the rhetoric and the reality, whereas a lot of the money, most people are much better off just now than they were 10 years ago, unquestionably. But there are a few people that are even more better off, because they've been, the corruption is there, and they've been skimming a lot of the revenues off the top. So there's, there's increasing recognition of that among the population too.
Well, it sounds like they got the same kind of excellent economic advice from Goldman Sachs that the rest of us got. let me ask part of that, though. How much of this, the discussion over missile defense systems that were going to be put on land in Poland, and and then shifted now to ships in the Black Sea, subject, of course, to whatever agreements we have with Turkey about how long our warships can stay in the Black Sea, I guess. How much of that is tied into that psyche, or are they really perceived some greater threat from a land-based system than from a ship-based system?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that they would... To them, the whole American fixation on missile defense looks irrational from the Russian point of view. They sort of think, if you're gonna, you know, if you're really worried about what you say you're worried about, Iran or North Korea or something, well, theater missile defense is perfectly sufficient. So we don't understand, you know, your rhetoric about, you know, if you want some kind of national missile defense kind of, you know, kind of more, something more global than just the theater, then what your reasons for, you got to come up with some reasons for wanting that that makes sense. Now, from their point of view, the only reason that you would want something broader than just those kind of narrow theater is against Russia. So they don't, there's a lot of, the top military people are still, even now, we're still trained in the Soviet period. They don't, just like we have our Cold Warriors, they have their Cold Warriors. And so there's a lot of mistrust there. If there was a way to work, you know, the best way to convince them of we mean what we say on this is to, you know, get them involved on a real level. Now, that may be a no-go politically here, but that's, you know, if we're really worried about North Korea and Iran, work with the Russians to contain that threat. They've done quite, they from their point of view, they've shown their under the sanctions in Iran, for example, they've stopped military sales to Iran. They're enforcing the sanctions. They're trying to show themselves to be trustworthy on that. From their point of view, U.S. should reciprocate somehow. It's a tough issue because there's politics involved and there's lack of trust and a lot of things.
One thing I find interesting with Russia is the fact that they continue to have an ongoing, it's mostly a mercantile relationship, but an ongoing relationship with both China and India when it comes to the sale of weaponry. And when you talk about China, you talk about India, and you ask them who are their largest potential rivals in this century, they look at each other. Where does Russia see themselves with their relationship with China and India? Is it strictly a business relationship with weapons, or do they see one or the other possibly being a strategic partner from a national security standpoint?
Yeah, I think they're two very different attitudes. With China's much more complex relationship for them because, as I said, China kept their defense industries alive for the 90s, and now we see a big drop in military sales to China, in large part because China is now producing lots of fairly sophisticated weaponry on their own, in some cases copies of stuff that Russia sold them previously. So they see, they've kind of have that business relationship with China and want to maintain it on the one hand. On the other hand, they're scared to death of them because they see, they're still worried that China will one day invade Siberia for the resources because as far as from the Russian point of view, it's a very sparsely populated area, hard to defend, very remote from sort of the center of Russia, and there's lots of Chinese, and, you know, they have this kind of, I don't know if I'd call it racist, but it's this kind of mindset, oh, well, there's these hordes of Chinese that could cross the border for either for extra living space or for their resources, and so there's this kind of there's a lot of parallels to U.S. attitudes towards migrants from Latin America and from Mexico, and Russian attitudes towards migrants from China, where there's this perception of this potentially huge threat as, and kind of, there's obviously some difference because we're not too worried about in the U.S. about Mexican invasion, but there is something there's some parallels there. In terms of India, I think it's much more of they don't feel any sense of threat from India, so there's a perfectly happy business relationship there. In fact, they've done a lot of cooperative development of military projects such as the Brahmos missile. They're now working on the fifth generation fighter aircraft together. So there's a lot of cooperation there, and they really see that relationship as being a crucial one for their defense industry going forward, as the relationship with China, I think, will decline over the next 10 years or so.
One of the, one of the questions I would have about what you just said is, if there is such a deep concern about the Chinese exploiting Siberian resources, why have the Russians not moved faster to exploit their own resources?
Well, they are moving. I mean, they're exploiting them as fast as they can in some ways. And you don't want to, there's only so much oil and natural gas you can produce in any given year. So they've been doing quite well in there. It's a difficult area to work in, especially now as they've moved. Most of the main new discoveries that are being made are offshore, and those are fairly hard to exploit, especially if you don't have a lot of previous experience with offshore drilling and so forth. We saw in the Gulf of Mexico this past year how that even at our technological level, with all the experience that in the U.S. and BP in the UK, with offshore drilling, mistakes get made, and the consequences can be quite terrible. And that's dealing with fairly warm water situations, whereas Russia's dealing with a lot of ice issues, there's some fields in the north, in the Arctic Ocean that they want to develop. So that's something where they really need foreign assistance to develop. But at the same time, they don't want to do necessarily, kind of production sharing. They want to hire somebody to come in and help them build what they want, and then keep the money, as much of the money as they can, to themselves. So that's, I wouldn't say that they've been lagging on exploiting the resources. They've been over there, gold and diamonds in Yakutia and other parts of Siberia. They've been there for decades working in those areas, and it's they don't want any more necessarily population there because it's economically doesn't make sense, to have people living in the far north. There's some academics and recently have argued that there's in fact too many people living in Siberia given the climate and the need to import basically food products and that kind of and every other needs from elsewhere in Russia. That's just not economically efficient. What you want is something more like what we have in our developing our resources in Alaska, where there are very few people and it's mostly automated, and then you get the resources down to mainland, as it were, where more people live, and it's rather than trying to, let's say, build a factory near where they have the oil or natural gas, pump it down to somewhere and build a factory somewhere else where it's cheaper to live. So that's kind of the tension over having population in Siberia versus just for strategic reasons versus the economic cost of having that population.
speaking of population, that kind of gives us a chance to pivot into one of my favorite areas. I love to death. Most people think it's dull, but it's dull but important. And that has to do with demographics. And Russia's demographic profile is just a complete horror show, whether you're talking about longevity or, even more important, births per woman. There was a real nice illustration of this, I believe, 2 years ago in The Economist, where they focused on, you know, Russia's ancient nemesis, the Tartars. And it talked about the area in western Siberia, or near the Ural Mountains, where the Tartars are now. It talked about the demographic profile, where the average Tartar not only lives longer, but the average Tartar female, I believe, was having between 5 and 6 children per woman. And they expanded the conversation to talk about, within 50 years' time, the ethnic and religious makeup of Russia is going to be dramatically different than it is right now. And if you could just talk for a minute about that, not only what direction that will have Russia heading, but have the Russians themselves internalize this demographic change that's going to take place in a generation or so, or is there some sense of denial?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite topics as well. I've actually done some presentations and written on Russian demographics, so I'll maybe even broaden what I talk about a little bit more than what you asked. First of all, the low birth rates are not so much an issue. The birth rates are really comparable to what you have elsewhere in Western Europe, and it's part of that demographic transition. So you have, you know, it's below replacement, yes, but it's not, and you know, in some ways the U.S. is more of an exception than other highly developed states, in that we're still above 2.0, I believe. But most, if you look at, you know, Italy is 1.3 births per woman, and, you know, most of Western Europe is in that kind of 1.3 to 1.7 range, and that's kind of where Russia is, too. So the real reason for the population decline was the high death rate, and that's really what the problem was that compared to other developed states, they had just had a much higher death rate at fairly young ages. So where, you know, which really affects reproduction as well as economic issues of having primarily men of working, of sort of prime working age, dying of, and it mostly had to do with alcohol. It was either some of the main causes of death were alcohol poisoning directly or accidents, which are also a high percentage of them related to alcohol. And then heart disease, which also can be in related to alcohol. So that was the big problem. What we've actually seen in the last couple of years is a slightly rosier picture. So since 2008, there has been a decline in death rates and an increase in birth rates. So that we now have, I think, if I remember correctly, I think they just had a census in October of 2010. We don't have the results yet, but. But I was looking at the Russian Statistics Bureau's website a little while ago, and I believe that the population actually grew last year, which was the first time in probably 15 or 20 years that it grew. So they're now on a better trajectory than they were before. Now this is all about talking about natural growth. The second part of the whole demographic challenge is migration, and that feeds into a lot of issues, because that's where you get the I think the change in the ethnic makeup of the population is going to be not so much from Tatars having 5 or 6 kids, that may be a factor, but not as big a one, as people migrating in from Central Asia for work, let's say, because economic prospects are better in Russia than they are there, and so you have more Tajiks and Kazakhs and whoever else, Azerbaijanis, and that has really fed a lot of xenophobia. And you saw that, and there were protests in Moscow a couple months ago related to this, where it's kind of Russian nationalist types were looking for people from the Caucasus basically to beat up, and the fact that the Caucasus is where a lot of the violence and terrorism comes from doesn't help this, obviously. So that's kind of, they're having a lot of issues with accepting that increase in migrants. But that, in a way, is, in terms of population stability, what we're going to see. I think there's going to be this kind of continuing, maybe slight increase in birth rates and decline in death rates, mostly just because as the economy has grown, people are more optimistic, so they have more children and so on. But there's still that impact of the children who were never born in the last 20 years that might have been. And so that will continue to keep to cause problems for the population. And the way to address that is with increased migration, but that then leads to xenophobia and all the political problems. So it's a complicated situation, but I think the picture is somewhat brighter than it has been any time since the Soviet Union collapsed.
I'm going to go back to oil and gas development a little bit, because I know one of their big projects for Russia is the Sakhalin Island development. And, you know, you were indicating earlier that the Mistrals might be going to the Pacific Fleet because of concerns over Japan or China. And I'm thinking of the new sea lane, which appears to be opening up, the northern route, and the fact that Sakhalin Island is LNG, among other things, an LNG source. Do you see a connection there at all? Or am I making things up by seeing a connection between their navy and the movement north on the Sakhalin Island?
Oh yeah, I think I think one of their missions for the navy is protection of offshore oil platforms or gas platforms, and also pipelines. So yeah, I think that there's definitely something to that. Again, I don't see realistically, I don't see an actual military threat there. You know, if China poses a threat to Russia, it's more of an economic threat than a military one. But you know, the job of defense planners is to be prepared for the most unlikely possibilities as well as the likely ones. So, and then from that point of view, China's, you know, there's more threat there than there is elsewhere on Russia's maritime border. So it makes sense from that point of view. And there will, and the Northern Passage also. So that will be, one of the missions of the Northern Fleet will be to protect that route. And given the geography, that's more of a Northern Fleet than a Pacific Fleet. Route, but they're both, you know, obviously they come around through the Bering Strait and around Kamchatka, then it gets down into the Pacific territory.
Hey, moving across the broad northern reach of Russia, when we talk about the relationship with some of the former Soviet republics, I know, especially for the NATO guys, a constant big question over their head. They don't like talking about it much because it makes the Germans nervous because they're afraid the Russians might be nervous. But the Poles love to talk about it, and it's not the whole question of missile defense, but Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. The Estonians are always, I kind of find it funny because I've talked to Russians who don't understand why the Estonians are the way they are. They say, we used to drive there from St. Petersburg, go to Tallinn for dinner and come back. We're all the same. You go to Estonia, and they all want to talk about the good times when they were, you know, were owned by the Swedish crown and how they're more Swedes and Finns and not those bad Russians. But that whole relationship is really touchy because they are still so economically intertwined, and a lot of them have significant Russian minorities. Estonia is one of them, obviously. Is that relationship with the Baltics maturing on both sides, or is that as fragile as it can be when you read the extremes on both ends that like to throw rocks at each other?
I think it is maturing, but very slowly. It's not as, you know, there's always extremes, and so on both sides there's, you know, there's extreme statements. And a lot of it is, the Baltics, the elites of the Baltic states still feel very much, you know, kind of traumatized by this Soviet occupation and really conflate Russia with that Soviet Union. Whereas from the Russian point of view, they keep saying, look, we're not, you know, that was the Soviet Union, we're Russia, we're not the same thing. And if you keep insisting that we are, that's only going to hurt our relations. On the other hand, I think for a lot, given what we talked about before about the sort of the humiliation and so forth, one of the main drivers of Russian foreign policy in general is a desire for respect, and particularly, I mean, from all countries in the world, but particularly from the former Soviet republics. I mean, that's even touchier than, let's say, the United States or China or whoever. So, and that's why you have these problems. You know, one country we haven't particularly mentioned is Georgia, but that's kind of in the same. There's certain commonalities. Georgia, the Baltic states, Ukraine under Yushchenko, as opposed to now with Yanukovych. These were all countries that they felt where the leadership didn't treat Russia with the respect that Russia deserved as a major regional power. And so that caused a lot of tension. So you can have, and Russians, I've talked to Russians, sort of foreign policy analyst types about this. You can, they say, look, we can have tensions over policy, you know, policy disagreements. You know, if you look at Russia-Azerbaijan relationship, there's often don't see eye to eye on issues. But there's not this kind of, and this is, you know, kind of in their words, this gratuitous tendency to insult, let's say, Putin that you see with Saakashvili from Georgia, or in some cases these kind of deliberate symbolic acts that you see in the Baltic states, where they put up statues to people who served in who helped the Nazis during World War II, or take down this Soviet monument to soldiers who died in World War II. So these are, this kind of the symbolism is very important for this respect kind of relationship, and that, I think, is driving a lot of the tensions. Because in a lot of cases, the economic relationships are quite good. And if you look at Latvia, there's, you know, especially in Latvia, where a lot of the businessmen are actually ethnic Russians, they have very good relations with business relations with their partners in Russia, and that's no problem. So there's this difference between the economic side and the political side.
When you talked earlier about the Black Sea and the potential for the Navy, Russian Navy expanding eventually, bring another Mistral into that area, you also had a comment on your blog post about an article that appeared in the Naval Institute Proceedings by, I think, an Army Lieutenant Colonel who saw more of a threat from the Black Sea Fleet than you appear to. Can you discuss that a little bit? Is that another issue of respect for the Russians, and is, how much of a threat do you perceive?
A threat to whom?
Well, that's the question.
Well, I guess, I mean, part of it is that the Black Sea Fleet, for now, is still in fairly poor shape. So, you know, they still have, I mean, they they have the Moskva, which is a cruiser, but that's a ship that's 30 years old, I believe, and they have other ships there that are 50 years old that I'm talking about combatants. So for now, there's there are plans, but a lot of times Russian shipbuilding plans don't either come to fruition late or not at all. So we'll see. For the moment, I just don't see the capabilities there to be much of a threat. So that's one. Two, I think part of my disagreement with that article was that I'm not sure how extensive U.S. interests. It was really sort of making this case that the U.S. had these great strategic interests in the Black Sea, and I'm not sure I see that. Maybe if you do end up with missile defense ships there, that would be one thing. But other than that, this is a fairly closed in sea where Turkey and Russia are the main players, and the U.S. Especially if I'm correct, and the pipelines become more of an economic issue than a political and strategic one, the U.S. doesn't have as much of a role there. So as far as if you're Georgia and you want to continue to have some designs on retaking Abkhazia and South Ossetia, then yeah, the Russia does present a threat from that point of view. But the Georgian interests aren't necessarily, I believe, aligned with U.S. interests in this regard. So that's why I said threat to whom. As far as I don't think any of the other countries should in the Black Sea need to fear Russia. It's not Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine. I just don't see or Turkey. I just don't see a threat there. Their main missions for the Black Sea Fleet, if the modernization does pan out the way they're planning it, are twofold. One is the anti-piracy, that'll be the main anti-piracy set of ships for the going down to Somalia. There is that kind of containing Georgia aspect to it, although Georgia doesn't really have much of a navy, so there isn't much there. And then, maybe threefold. And then the other one is trying to get back out to the Med, because that's something that the Soviet Union always did, and Russia kind of stopped, and they'd like to get back into that. They're refurbishing their base in Syria, Tartus, for that purpose. And so that's, I think, but that's more of a kind of a presence and showing the flag kind of operation. Because they've seen that if you go to friendly countries with your ships, then they tend to sign arms deals with you afterwards. They saw that in Venezuela. They've seen that in Southeast Asia. So I think that's part of it, too.
Well, Dmitry, we got about 45 seconds left in the show. Besides the work you do over at CNA, if our listeners wanted to catch up on what's going on with Russia, what would you recommend for them grab hold and read?
Well, gosh, there's one of the best people from Russia writing on Russia is a guy named Dmitry Trenin. So he's over at the Carnegie Moscow office, and he writes in all sorts of different places, Washington Quarterly. I think he's been in Foreign Affairs, but if you just follow his stuff, he's got a good idea of what Russia's doing, but he kind of understands the how the U.S. Readers interpret that kind of thing. So he's a good guy to follow. I'm trying to think of RFERL Power Vertical blog is very good for understanding domestic politics. If you're interested, so Trenin on foreign policy, Power Vertical at Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty on. And my blog, of course, on the Russian military.
Absolutely. Well, Dmitry, thank you very much for taking an hour of your time here today to come with us and talk about Russia. Now I can quit getting those emails reminding me to talk on Russia. I appreciate it a lot. It's been a very fast hour.
Yeah, I've had a great time.
We're the only people allowed to have technical problems.
our website send commentary. All right. Well, yeah, I've had a great time. This was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live and for hopping in the chat room. And we look forward to talking to you next week. And until then, I hope you have a great Navy Day.
It's a long way to Tipperary.